We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Michael Spector. He's a writer. He writes about science, technology, global public health for The New Yorker, where he's been a staff writer since 1998. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you'll find in his new book. The title is Denialism: How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives. It's just recently been published, and it's published by the Penguin Press. And in this book, he makes the argument that Americans today mistrust science, and they mistrust science more than ever before. He says, at one time, we celebrated scientific achievement. We had this belief that new information about the world was always good. It was always valuable. Now, he says, many people have come to see science as just another special interest group that does not necessarily serve our best interest. And in this book, he makes this argument for a return to the scientific method, essentially, which is a observation, experimentation, an approach to the world that he says served us pretty well for quite a long time, but now more and more people, it seems, have abandoned. As I mentioned, the book is out now. You can seek it out in the bookstore, in the library. Our guest has been writing, as I said, for The New Yorker for a number of years. He's received twice the Global Health Council's Excellence in Media Award, as well as the Science Journalism Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's with us on the telephone, and we also encourage people who are listening, if you have questions, comments, you'd like to be involved in the conversation, you can call us as well. We just hope people can keep it brief. That way we can keep it moving, get in as many callers as possible, but callers are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Mr. Spector, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Rather than just simply asking for a definition right up front, maybe it might make more sense to start right in with an example, and you give a number of them the book. And actually, interestingly enough, just the hour before this, we had a local physician here on the program, and we were talking about flu. We got a number of questions from people about vaccines and who should be vaccinated. And this is one of the things that you talk about in the book. And certainly we've seen now, that the general recommendations is that everyone should indeed be vaccinated. But there seems to be some fair amount of resistance out there for a variety of reasons. Not all of them make much sense. But that's probably a good place for us to start, and a good example of what it is that you're talking about.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a very good place to start. I wouldn't say the resistance is for a variety of reasons. I would say it's for one signature reason, which is that fear has become as infectious as any other disease we might get. And people are afraid. They're afraid of a vaccine. 41% of Americans say they don't want this flu vaccine. This flu vaccine has probably the finest safety profile of a vaccine out there today. So far, about 62 million people have received it. There may be two or three significant reports out of 62 million people of serious adverse effects. You have to compare that to thousands of people dead. In this country, 5,000 so far, 20 million infected, and this is a mild flu. It could get worse. The idea that people do not want to be vaccinated with a vaccine that has proven so safe and effective, it's a very disturbing, and it sort of strikes to the point that I'm writing about, which is we are more worried about scientific achievement and progress in what we can accomplish than we've ever been. And there are reasons, both good and bad, for that. But the net result is very damaging.
Yeah. One of the things that I find curious now, and I don't know how common this would be, but I think that there, if we went out and we asked people, you know, would you get the vaccination for H1N1? And among those people who would say no, I wonder if we then asked them, have you ever gotten a flu shot before? Whether we might actually find some people who would say, yes, they had. But in this particular case, they're saying, but this one, no. I mean, I guess that's the one that I really don't quite understand.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't get a flu shot, and they ought to, but people tend to think flu is something that you get and you stay in bed for a couple days and you feel crappy. And that's usually true, except that it does kill about 35,000 people in America every year, and it makes people very, very sick from time to time. Now, most of the time, that isn't the case. The idea that people won't have this shot because they're worried that it might hurt them is the thing that bothers me. And there's quite a substantial group of people that applies to. This is the same flu shot, by the way, that we get every year. The only reason it's different at all is because the virus emerged a couple months too late to be wrapped into the normal seasonal shot that they prepare each year. Otherwise, there would have just been one flu shot, not two.
Here, and this is perhaps related to a larger kind of issue about vaccines, not just about vaccines for flu, but about vaccines, a growing fear, as you say, a growing fear that the vaccine will hurt you, so that either it's people who are deciding they don't want it for themselves, but maybe more than that, it is people who are deciding that they don't want that for their children.
Right. Well, the vaccine issue is when I wrote about the vaccine issue in my book, which I finished a few months before the swine flu emerged, that wasn't an issue. But the thing that did bother people was the idea that somehow there was some relationship between autism and receiving vaccines. Mm. And that is both a completely understandable fear and one that has been disproven time and time again. It's understandable because the rate of autism is rising. Kids tend to display their problems with development between the first and second year of life, and that's about the same time you get a lot of vaccines. So any normal parent is going to say, what happened at the time that my kid went haywire? What can I look to? And vaccines are the first most obvious thing that you would look at, and you should look at it, and you should be suspicious and wonder what the heck happened. And people have done that. We've done studies all over the world. There have been studies of millions of children. And it's not that difficult a study to do, because there are so many kids who have been vaccinated and many who have not. And what you see time and again in this country and nearly a dozen others in Europe and Canada, among different age groups and different racial backgrounds, is that the rate at which people develop autism is the same, just exactly the same, in the group that's been vaccinated and the group that hasn't. So how could vaccines possibly be the answer to this?
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, it doesn't go away.
Yeah. Just one other thing associated with vaccines, and I think that this was something that we had actually started to see maybe before the fear side of it became so big, and that was people deciding not to, or maybe not even thinking about vaccinating their children because they don't see the reason.
An unfortunate consequence of the excellence of vaccination. I mean, vaccinations are the most effective public health measure that has ever been undertaken in the world, except for clean water. And what has that meant? It's meant we don't know about measles. You know, 200,000 kids died in the world of measles last year, but we don't know that because it didn't happen in our country. And we don't have polio in this country. We don't have smallpox. We don't know what it is. It isn't that long ago that parents were petrified about polio. And it wasn't that long ago that people died of smallpox. I'm not talking about hundreds of years. I'm talking about a generation or two. Those things are gone. And because they're gone, it's very difficult to get worked up about them because you don't even know what they are. But some of them can come back, for sure. We've seen that with measles. It could happen with polio.
And that, so here is part of what we're talking about simply an educational issue
people don't have the information
that they really should.
Well, a lot of it is that, but a lot of it is other things. I mean, we have, you know, when I grew up, I was I was told that, you know, authority was great. The president was always right. Science could cure everything. Hunger wouldn't be a problem. If there wasn't enough water, we'd get the salt out of the water in the sea. We'd take care of all the problems in the world through science. Now, that just hasn't been true. Science makes grave mistakes, and if we rely too much on it or any other tool, we're going to be very sad. And we've seen many instances in our lifetimes, from Chernobyl to Karen Quinlan, where science has not done what it's supposed to do. It's made life more complicated, more dangerous, and more difficult. So when a government tells you, gee, take this pill, swallow this, take this drug, take this vaccine, people are skeptical now, and they have the right to be skeptical. They want to control these things themselves. And I think that's fine. I just also think that sometimes the pendulum has swung so far in the other direction that we are unwilling to even entertain the idea that these things are the reasons that we are prosperous and healthy.
Yeah. I guess that really, in my mind here, that points to what the dilemma is. I think here, as you just said, there's this line that really jumps off the page for me in the introduction where you write, we no longer trust authorities in part because we used to trust them too much.
Yeah.
Well, so then that gets this really important question, like, okay, how do you strike the appropriate balance between trusting them too much and trusting them not at all?
Well, I think education is a very important part of it. I mean, for one thing, people always say, well, how do I know when a government official says, you know, this is a drug that works or this is a study that disproves another study? I'm not a scientist. How do I know? Mm-hmm. And my response to that is that very often, you know, people, one thing about Americans, they have a tremendous amount of common sense. You can look at the newspaper report and just, you don't have to be a scientist to ask a couple simple questions like, who produced this study? How many people were in it? Was it 50 or 500 or 50,000? Did it last a week, a month, 3 years? Was it repeated? Because if things were just done once, then the validity of them really has to be suspect. But if it was done many times in many places with the same result, then you can start thinking, well, this must be a verifiable truth. I think those are things that we are all capable of. And unfortunately, the Internet both helps and hurts, because you can get every piece of information you want in the world on the Internet, including endless amounts of drivel that is dangerous and untrue. And sometimes it's really hard to know which is which.
Well, you're pointing at that, you're saying that what people really should have is what amounts to a very rudimentary understanding of how science works, what the scientific method is, what scientists do. You'd think, well, didn't you get that in seventh grade?
Unfortunately, they didn't. I mean, I'm a big believer that, you know, I have a 16-year-old, and she's being taught physics and chemistry, and that's fine. I doubt she'll go into those fields. I could be wrong. What I would prefer for her to be taught is simple statistics, because most of what I'm talking about here is just risk. When we talk about things like genetically engineered food, which is one of these issues that I write about a lot, people are always saying, how do we know? How do we know it's not dangerous? Oh, my God. Well, we know a couple things. We know that it's been planted in this country for 25 years, that 2 billion acres have been planted, and there has never been a single human demonstrated to have been made sick or die from eating it. So when people say, how do you know it will never harm us? The answer is, we don't know. There's nothing like certainty. People get into a car every day, and they don't know they're going to be alive at the end of the drive. There is a risk in everything we do, but people don't think that way. And I really think they need to start weighing, you know, the top and the bottom number of every fraction.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Michael Spector. He writes about science, technology, and global public health for The New Yorker, where he's been a staff writer since 1998. And we are talking about some of the ideas you will find in his new book. It's titled Denialism, and it's published by the Penguin Press. So we have several callers here. We'll get to them, and we'll start locally here with the first person in line, and that's someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
How much weight would you attach to, in your studies, if you could talk about this briefly, the connection between the distrust of science, scientific method, and maybe even we could go a little further and say fuzzy thinking in general, and religious convictions, most prominent clash between those two, of course, being over evolution. But I've noticed just anecdotally in my own life that the people that are most skeptical about science and medical advances and so on and so forth have an interesting system of fuzzy thinking that basically works along the lines of, well, I believe this because I want to believe it, and facts, evidence, proofs to the contrary mean nothing to me. This is something I've decided because I want it that way, and so forth. Could you comment on that, please? Thank you.
Yeah, I can. I mean, I'll say a couple things. One is, I think you're completely right about the fuzzy thinking. I don't like to attribute it to a religion. When it comes to creationism, I think that all religions have fundamentalist elements and they're not to be reasoned with. So I didn't even really write about creationism in my book because I kind of feel if you believe that your ancestors rode around on the backs of dinosaurs, I don't think I can have a useful conversation with you. But I do feel that this general issue of fuzzy thinking is an issue of we prefer our own emotions, our own anecdotal experience to a stack of statistics. If a kid gets sick, you don't want to be told that the kid didn't get sick from the thing that makes sense to you, and you have a bunch of data to prove it. And so it's very difficult to overcome our emotional reactions to things, but I think it can be done. It has been done. It's done all the time. But we have to demonstrate it, and sometimes we don't do that. And when I say we, I think scientists are to blame, and I think journalists are very much to blame, and I include myself. We tend to hype the things that are exciting and dangerous and scary, and we certainly did that with the swine flu a lot, and ignore the subtleties too much, and it filters down.
All right. Let's go to Bloomington to our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, the reason why people are skeptical with science is look what they're finding out now about the environmental issues. I'm 53. Going on 54, when I was in high school and college, they were telling everybody the opposite of science there. And then you've got some people on the news lately with the breast cancer incident, you know, and the mammograms. I'm a personal believer that these people don't know what they're doing. I think, look at computers. They don't, I mean, you can't buy one and have one break down a year or two later. We have science that, you know, we're working on another spacecraft, and they're coming up with all kinds of problems. And, of course, it's being based through, you know, some of the computer stuff. And it's some of the sciences that are out there, it's just wacko. I don't think we've been around long enough to study this stuff. I think that's the big problem. I think people need to start realizing that, you know, we've only been here as intelligent humans to study this with all the stuff we have now for, you know, maybe 50, 100 years. And it takes, you know, 100, you know, 200, 300 years to study this stuff, and I think that's what we're coming up against. I'll get off and listen. Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah, I have to really disagree with you. I think the amount of knowledge we have and the amount of knowledge we're gaining every decade is astonishing. I mean, we can look through molecular biology and see how we are related to an elephant that lived 40 million years ago. I mean, I don't think it's true that we haven't been around long enough to study this stuff. Things break. Things go wrong. The bit about the mammograms, that's just really a tale of more knowledge coming out over time, and that never will stop. It's a difficult and complicated issue. Not all things are black and white. Sometimes science has been promoted as a sort of final arbiter, and it almost never is. I mean, things are subtle. That mammogram issue is very subtle, and it basically says that, you know, it asks the question, is what our guidelines are now, are they worth it? And that's a very difficult question to answer because there's lots of factors that you have to include, including priorities and money and how you're going to even do the mammograms. So I don't think that I would say we haven't been around long enough to use science, because I think since the Enlightenment, science has been the thing that has driven us from living 30, 40 years to living 80, and it's only been a couple hundred years that that's happened.
Well, let's go on to another caller, and back here to Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is a terrific guest to have on. You've already created a very intriguing conversation. And I do think, Mr. Spector, you need to emphasize that science brings up a lot of possibilities, and they are not always going to be correct as new information emerges. And something like the mammograms, it is partly about understanding statistics. It worries me a great deal that it's very difficult to have simple conversations that come from an information base. And I'm going to ask some of you media folk to take some responsibility for that. We seem to have a lot of media screamers who know how to hit some hot-button issues, often from the evangelical right, but not necessarily, sometimes the political right. But science can be a little bit scary, and I think you need to advertise that, if I may use that word, and suggest this is always going to be a risk. But it's to everybody's interest to understand more about it. And every time any kind of test, and I don't mean like a medical test, but when you set up experiments and the results are suppressed because they did not show what the scientist hoped it would show or the sponsoring agency hoped it would show, and people find that out, that becomes another factor in saying we're not as ethical as we need to be. So advertise the lack of certainty and the importance of information. And I can't wait to read your book. Thanks so much. Please discuss some of the issues with Americans remaining so ignorant of science.
All right. I appreciate the call. You can comment on that any way you like.
I'm not really sure how to comment. I mean, I think I've already said in this conversation that the press is as much to blame. There's no group of Americans who are not to blame for this problem. It's not like scientists or journalists or anyone else. Religious people are exempt from these issues. And we always have to talk, when I say about the risks and benefits, I mean, we need to talk about both of them. When we talk about genetic engineering, we need to say these things can be miraculous because they can. We can also and should also say, have they been miraculous? Is it worth the effort? You know, we need to discuss what we're going to do about our climate problems. Well, some of that will involve some pretty sophisticated science, I believe, and I think it's wonderful, but it also raises incredible questions about how far we want to go when it comes to creating organisms. And those are things that scare people, and they should scare people. And in the past, we've just sort of unleashed our new science. Nobody had a conversation about the internet before it was out there, or trains. And I think the time has come, if we're going to start creating organisms that can digest carbon or fuel our cars without emitting CO2, to discuss how valuable that is and what the dangers are. And then let us decide together whether it's worth it. I think we would decide that it is worth it, but I think that conversation has not occurred, and it really needs to.
Well, here, it seems to me that this is a really important point, because that kind of conversation, it seems that when it comes to introducing new novel technologies, we've never done that. And
no, I don't think that's true.
Well, give me
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Oh, right. Okay. So it seems that we have tended to embrace very enthusiastically, without much question, every new technology that comes along, and at the same time, I think there are a lot of people who would say, you know, that's not that we should indeed have, as a society, we should have a conversation, and the ideal time would be before you introduce the new technology.
It's when the only time to have it. I think the problem with genetically engineered food is, you know, people call these genetically modified organisms, but it's ridiculous. All the food we eat is genetically modified. There were no tangerines in the Garden of Eden. We have, over thousands of years, modified plants and animals so that we can eat them and deal with them in the ways we want. Now, genetic engineering is a more precise way to do that, and it has greater promise and also carries some different, I wouldn't necessarily say greater, but it definitely has some different risks. But that just stuff popped out, and it popped out in a way where, you know, companies and scientists said this will solve a lot of the world's problems. And actually, it can do that. But what it's mostly done has been used to grow a bunch of corn and soybean that's fattened cows that we eat too much of that cause a lot of environmental and health issues. And we don't talk about cassava, which 300 million sub-Saharan Africans need to live on, that has no protein, it's just a bunch of calories, it has no micronutrients, and now they're engineering all of that into cassava so that if you're stuck eating that, you're not going to go blind and you're not going to die at the age of 27, and that's a wonderful thing. But it's 30 years on. You know, this isn't how we started. This is what we're doing now. And so, yeah, we need to have those conversations very urgently, I think.
Well, then the question is, how does that happen? How do we make those conversations happen?
Well, I say in the book, and people can laugh, I think we should have a national conversation, and I think the leader of our nation should lead it. And I know that this particular president cares about science. He's appointed people who care about these issues. And if he's going to have national summits on things like jobs and the economy, which God knows he should have, I don't know that those things are more vital to our future than dealing with our immense climate crisis, which we have created. And I think we should have conversations in universities, on the corporate level, in the national arena, and that they should be broadcast. And I really don't think it would be too hard to have a few of those and get people thinking and at least understanding that these issues exist, because half of the people in this country don't even know that they exist.
We have some other callers. We brought to midway through this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Michael Spector. He writes about science, technology, and global public health for The New Yorker, where he's been staff writer since 1998, and he's the author of a newly published book. The title is Denialism, the subtitle, How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives. It's published by the Penguin Press. And we have a number of people here who'd like to join in with some thoughts, comments, questions, whatever. We'll go next to Urbana and line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
First, let me congratulate you on having made it to not only The Daily Show, but WILL as well.
I'm proud.
And I want to raise an issue that may lead us to the human nature that's behind this issue of what I think of as immediate, short-term, impulsive thinking instead of long, thoughtful analysis and decision, and that would be the topic of the deniability that someone you have decided that you want to be with, romantically especially, is not the right person. The stories of people who form attachments, especially when young and first practicing this process of deciding who you want to be with, is full of tales of what was I thinking? What made me think that was a good choice? And on the other end, there are people who have been in relationships that they should not have stayed in, and they simply talk themselves into some reason for doing so. So if you could talk about the basic human nature that is exemplified by these kinds of attachments, and whether that has something to do with our thinking on other more object or what should be more objective topics.
I think why people fall in love with each other may be above my pay grade, but look,
the question is, why do they stay together for longer than they suddenly...
I understand. I mean, people are ruled by emotions and different needs and different connections, and it's not simple. We're not computers. We don't sit down and do the statistics. We never are only going to do that. I'm only suggesting that we do that in addition to everything else. We're always primarily going to be people who react on our gut, and I think that's okay. I think our gut works a lot. Pretty well, but it doesn't solve the big problems. And I think we're capable of doing that because for the last several hundred years, we have shown ourselves to be remarkably capable of doing it. I mean, the things that we do now as a society are remarkable. For instance, I'm in New York. I don't even know how the phone beams to Illinois and all your listeners hear it. I don't need to know that. It's not important. I just need to know that it works. But increasingly, I think we're worried about how these things work, and we feel like we're removed from it. So when we feel that, I think we kind of retreat into our emotions. And that's kind of a denialism. I mean, it's a completely normal and understandable thing, and it happens in human relationships, and it happens in all relationships.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. it seems to me, though, that we're making the assumption that given good information, that we would hope that people would make a would weigh that and would make a rational choice and make a good decision, or at least part of the time make good decision. It seems, though, that one problem is that we don't always have access to information. And one of the reasons that people don't trust big pharmaceutical companies and big government and big business is because we know, and we have plenty of examples, that they're holding out on us. And, you know, how can you make a good decision if somebody has information, but they're keeping it locked up and you don't know about it?
Well, this is one of the problems, and I think that it's not so much locked up as that there are lies about what the impact of the information is. Mm. And I write in my book about an example of that, because about Vioxx, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. And one reason I do is I want anyone who reads this book to understand that I see why there are reasons for denialism. This isn't an insane sort of movement. It's based on reality. But with Vioxx, that was a drug that was introduced by Merck to great fanfare. And it was supposed to treat people with arthritis. There are millions of such people who take aspirin and Advil. You can only take so much of those drugs. It hurts your stomach. Sometimes it can kill you. Vioxx seemed to take all those problems away. It alleviated the pain without the gastrointestinal distress, and it seemed like a miracle until people started dropping dead. And they dropped dead in great numbers. The FDA has estimated about 55,000, which is roughly how many Americans died in Vietnam. And those people tended to be people with heart issues, obesity, diabetes, previous heart attacks. But Merck knew this, or they knew the likelihood of this, and they did not give the information out properly. You could find it, and some researchers did, but they certainly weren't advertising it. And that was criminal, really. But so they took the drug off the market, as they should have, and everyone realizes that, except I raise this issue in the book, and it isn't about defending a pharmaceutical company who completely did the wrong thing. It's about thinking about risk. Millions of Americans took that drug and it alleviated their pain. They no longer can. The truth is that if that drug were prescribed properly to people without cardiovascular risks, when we know how to find out what your cholesterol level is, your blood pressure, did you have a heart disease history in your family, things like that, if you prescribe it to the right people, then the risk really isn't very terrible. And most people would say, sure, I'd rather have the 1 in 500 risk of having a heart attack and get rid of my pain. That is what a drug should be able to do. The idea that a drug can be approved and it has to be safe for every American, it's crazy. If we all took two aspirin right now in this entire country, 500 people would be dead by the end of the day. We have to do a better job. Now, we don't do a better job, and when a drug's approved, a doctor can do whatever he or she wants with it, and that is a problem. But I don't think the answer is to search for drugs that will never harm anyone and will help everyone, because we're never going to find that.
All right. Again, to the next caller, and that would be somebody in Atlanta. I think it's probably Atlanta, Illinois, not Atlanta, Georgia, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Great conversation. I just love it. And, you know, you've hit on some really important things like education. The importance of that is that we're educating probably a little bit in the wrong direction, and we need to educate people to think and to evaluate truth, and we don't do that. So this again, is a great conversation. One of the points I wanted to make is back to the science issue is I think one place science might have gone astray is that funding for a lot of science projects and science ideas now comes from the private sector instead of the government, which is us, and we as a government probably should be funding these experiments rather than having people with vested interest. And I've seen this personally even back as far as the 50s and 60s, where when information was going astray to what the funder wanted to, he dropped funding. So one, there's two reasons. Firstly, you might get a biased scientific explanation for whatever you're studying. Secondly, a lot of researchers now have to spend most of their time digging around for funds rather than doing work, which is just absolutely wasteful. So, you know, I think science is the thing that we need to rely on, but we definitely need to improve science. in some of the ways would be a little bit more objectivity and also not so much specialization. Science has become really specialized, and people overlook the big picture, I think. And I think that's another problem that needs to be addressed. And I'll shut up and let you comment. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the comments.
Thanks for calling. I think one of the issues that you raised is a really important one, which is the sort of private sector relationship with public research. And, you know, I this is a very difficult issue because it costs a lot to do science. But, again, I think if we focused more, gave more money to places like NIH, we could do more basic research there. We do a lot already. But no, if you look at a drug, you often find that it's been the research has been funded by the companies who benefit from it, and it's very difficult for any person to just walk away and say, well, you know, they just have our good interests in heart. You know, they charge a ton of money. I mean, I write about this, and I write about vitamins, and one of the reasons people embrace vitamins, which are almost uniformly useless, is that they're running away from a healthcare system that sucks, that costs too much, and that doesn't tell the truth. So if they think Big Pharma lies, they can walk into their local vitamin store and everything seems natural and real. And the more we know about these things, the more we know they're not natural, they're not real, and they're not helpful. But I certainly do understand the urge, and we need to kind of break the sort of industrial relationship with, you know, research institutions if we're going to stop this.
All right. We are moving into about our last 15 minutes. Again, let me very quickly introduce our guest, Michael Spector. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, has been there since 1998. He writes about science, technology, global public health, and is the author of a new book. And if you want to read more on this kind of subject we're talking about, you should look for his book. It's titled Denialism, and it's published by Penguin Press. And we have other callers, and we'll continue to talk with folks next with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. The previous guest stated or recommended that we should get the regular flu vaccine and the H1 flu vaccine. But it seems to me it would be impossible to determine the long-term consequences of the swine flu vaccine because it is an evolving germ that has its own unique properties, and the only way to study the long-term effects is in the long term.
Okay.
Actually, that isn't true. It's not an I mean, every virus, every molecule mutates and evolves. This flu virus is exactly like any other flu virus that exists. It's a new one. The vaccine for it is exactly like every vaccine we ever give people every year. It just has the different proteins in it. As to long-term studies, well, we've been giving vaccines like this for many, many years. The safety profile is remarkably good. Again, this is a risk issue. How much study do you want? You know, how many people have to die of the flu before you say, okay, maybe taking a vaccination is worth it? Because sure, maybe 31 years from now we'll find out that taking a flu shot causes some illness. But in the meantime, hundreds of thousands or more people will have died.
This was also something that we talked about in the conversation with the previous guest, the local physician, the fact that, and again, I don't know if this is something people really understand, that the viruses that cause influenza are constantly mutating. That's why it is you got to get a new shot every year. And if this H1N1 had happened at the regular time that flu comes along, they would have put it in what we're calling the seasonal flu vaccine, and nobody would have thought about it.
Right.
People probably would have just lined up just like they, you know, just like they always line up.
They also called it the swine flu, which is one of the dumbest things the CDC has done in a long time, because it isn't a swine flu. It hadn't infected any pigs. All flu viruses are a mix of human genes, bird genes, pig genes, and this is no different. To call it the swine flu just made people think of our debacle of 1977, when there was a swine flu that affected very few people, but we vaccinated 150 million, and we had quite a few bad reactions. None of that is true here, yet it scared the hell out of people, and I don't think we need more fear. We need less.
Yeah. Well, I guess I find myself coming back again and again to the subject of risk. And the points that you make, first of all, the point that, well, we don't like to think about it, but that somehow when we do, we're really bad at figuring out where risk is. We're worried about things that we shouldn't be, and then we're not worried about things that we probably should be worried about.
Well, the thing is, the risk of not doing something is often far greater than the risk of doing it. So whenever people say, how do we know we can eat this? Is it safe? How do we know we can have this shot? They never say, well, what would happen if we didn't have this? Because the answer often is 300 million people would starve to death. Or if we didn't have this vaccine, which we're asking whether it's safe or not, millions could die of, you know, of terrible epidemic. I mean, those things are part of the equation, but they're never seen somehow as part of the equation.
We have other callers, and we'll go next to line two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Maybe we go back to genetic modification for a moment. You said, and quite correctly, that we have been genetically modifying plants and animals for thousands of years now. And
yep.
It has resulted in a much more productive agriculture. The difference and the danger with genetic modification isn't the technology. It's the danger of introducing a new species into any ecosystem. And unless you study the situation carefully and test it rigorously, you don't quite know what will happen in many cases. I would point to the use of Roundup Ready soybeans and corn. What's happening now is that weeds are developing immunity to the Roundup, and in a few years it will no longer be effective. There's a possibility with genetic modification that you will actually introduce something that would be as dangerous, say, as the Asian carp. But the solution isn't to prohibit genetic modification. It's to study it carefully and don't leave the decisions to interested parties like farmers and chemical companies. Study it with impartial observers. I'll hang up and
okay.
Listen to what you have to say.
I think that you might at least in part be in agreement with the caller.
Well, I'm certainly in agreement on the second part. The idea that, you know, if you're going to let... When I talk about this in front of people, and I seem to be doing a lot of that lately, when they complain about genetically engineered, and I don't call it modified, I call it engineered, what they mostly seem to be complaining about is the corporate control of the technology. And that, I think, is a legitimate complaint. I think people worry about farmers being able to get seeds that aren't patented. And I believe the Obama administration is looking pretty vigorously at that. That's a real problem. But you have to remember something. Science is not a company. It's a way of doing something. And it's a way of doing something that works. On the issue of Roundup Ready and glyphosate, that is a problem of monoculture. That's a problem of having too many single crops in the same area and not having biodiversity. And even though that's laid to the door of genetically engineered foods, it should not be. This is a question of how you plant your crops. And it would be a problem if we didn't have genetically engineered food and we had monocultures.
It just, I suppose, that though some the caller would say that would agree with you in the sense that, yes, it would be a problem. It's just that if we're doing this and that we're using much more of the chemical than we did before, then what we're doing is we're accelerating the process. The same thing could be happening.
Here's the problem with that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What we're doing is using immensely less insecticide than we have ever used before because of Roundup Ready. I mean, the numbers are remarkable, and we're not even requiring more pesticide than we are before. You know, in China, cotton farmers have eliminated like 150 million pounds of insecticide in 1 year just by using genetically engineered varieties. I've never understood why environmentalists have been so opposed to something that's so good for the environment, and I think many are coming around. And I do agree with the caller that there are problems, and we need to deal with those problems, but they're not really problems of the science. They're problems of how we work as you know, how farmers work, how agriculture is implemented. And those are real problems that have to do with what we want in this country and how we eat and what we grow. And those things can be, and I think are beginning to be, addressed.
Okay. I want to make sure we get at least one more caller. We have holding on here someone in Danville. This is line three.
Yes, thank you.
Yes.
Goodness, I wish we had more time because there's so much that you said that I'd love to talk about. But starting with H1N1, you know, it was billed as this major, major pandemic that everybody was going to die if you didn't take it. Well, it hasn't turned out that way. You talk about distrust. I mean, that's a good place to start. You know, there's 35,000 people that die each year from the flu. There are 11,000 known viruses. When you get a flu shot, you're getting a shot for a particular flu. All right? How many other hundreds or thousands you could get, it's out there. So, you know, to think that you get a flu shot and you're not going to get a flu is one of the biggest misnomers that is out there, which also leads to, again, a trust factor. When you said that we've been genetically modifying organisms for 1,000 years, we've been taking and modifying our livestock and our corn by selective breeding. Genetically modifying an organism, which we really do not know what ultimately that will do, is a big change. There's a huge difference between spraying a field to kill bugs and putting it in the genetics of the plant that you ingest. That's a huge difference. I mean, I'm surrounded by fields here. I have an organic farm that the soil is completely dead. There's no life there. There's no worms. There's no organisms. It's been sterilized. So, you know, when you're sitting there saying science is it, science works, you know, we have to trust it. When it's funded privately, when you have major corporations that are taking and making huge profits and you know which direction they're headed, you know, there's a mistrust there, but it is justified in so many ways.
Well, go ahead, Michael.
Not to respond to. First of all, on the H1N1, I have to disagree with pretty much everything you said. Flu shots are an educated guess. They're a combination of the viruses that go around, and they're usually about 70 to 80% effective. And believe me, that's immensely valuable in saving and improving lives. The idea that because H1N1, thank the Lord, has not been as virulent as it might have been is no reason not to prepare it any more than getting in a car and not having an accident is a reason not to wear a seatbelt. We do these things because there is a possibility of a pandemic. This was a newly characterized virus, and it could have been and may yet be very deadly. It's unlikely. We're lucky. But the idea that we shouldn't protect ourselves is crazy. And then on the genetically modified food stuff, I just couldn't disagree with you more. And again, what you really seem to be talking about is not science, it's companies. And companies are issues that we can debate and discuss, but it isn't the science. The idea that somehow there's a fundamental difference in the way we rearrange molecules when we do genetic engineering, that's just not true. And it's, as far as using chemicals on the soil, or organics use chemicals, organic farmers love to spray BT insecticide. Somehow that's fine. But if you put the BT toxin in a plant, then somehow it's against the laws of nature. I've never understood that, and neither have many other people. These are issues of how you use the land. They're not whether you're modifying something or not.
I mean, I just, if the caller's there, I can give you a chance for a real quick follow-up, but we're getting really short on time.
Yes, I can put a seatbelt on in a car, but if that car coming towards me all of a sudden grows spikes, that seatbelt...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said I can put on a seatbelt in a car, but if that car coming towards me all of a sudden mutates into spikes, it's not going to help me. And that's what this whole debate is about.
Asking, is there 100% certainty that you'll get a vaccine and it will protect you? The answer is and will always be no.
Then why should I take it?
Because
why don't I let my own body take care of it?
It's statistically useful to get it than to not get it. And if people didn't get the vaccine, if no one got the vaccine, so many more tens of thousands of people would be dead and ill and incapacitated that it isn't even a statistical debate worth having.
But the ones that are left are going to be the strongest genetically that can be.
Well, if you want to wipe out a third of the world to have stronger people, then fine. Then that's what we ought to do.
That's what we've done. That's what nature has done throughout history.
Okay. I think we probably have said what we need to say to each other on this.
That's what I thought.
Well, all right. Well, we're in any case, we're just about at the point that we are going to have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute or so left. Last thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Yeah, I just think, again, with this caller and others, the issue is what is the risk of doing something versus what is the risk of not doing something? His contention that, you know, maybe if we didn't take the vaccine, a third or half of the world would die, but the ones that survived would be better. Well, if you want to cull the herd and cut out half of the people on Earth, then we should totally walk away from science and progress in modern life. I myself don't think that's the route to take, and I bet most people are on my side on this.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Michael Spector. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, has been there since 1998. He writes about science, technology, global public health. And if you'd like to read more of his thinking on the subject we've been discussing here, look for the book that is titled Denialism, the subtitle How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, Threatens Our Lives. It's published by the Penguin Press. Mr. Spector, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.